Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We have been covering a lot of football here in January and the road to the Super Bowl, but certainly the bigger road is the road that leads to what we hope will be a peaceful transition of power here in the United States of America. Can't believe I've been on the radio 30 years and I just said that out loud. Don Moeller is here. All of it brought to you by our friends at Fadley's, where you can still get crab cakes. Don, I'm going to continue to tell this story. My wife doesn't love seafood or thought she didn't love seafood. I went over, I picked up some fresh bronzini last week and we filleted that, did that upright, some steak fish. And of course, I brought crab cakes home. And here's a story. During the game, she starts to make a crab cake for me, literally second quarter. And I came over and the crab cake was missing a little corner of it. And I'm like, you don't like crab cake. And then she opened her mouth and she's eating the crab cake. She said, that's pretty good. And I'm like, all right, I'm moving her. So Fadley shipped those crab cakes. And our friends at State Fair, of course, and El Guapo over in Catonsville and Don's homeland, and our friends at Franco's, get on out, support local, take care of each other out there. We're going through some tough times right now. Don, this is going to be a thrilling conversation. I mean, you know, you've been the executive producer here at Baltimore Positive and booking some guests. I know it's been a while. You've been wanting to get Doug on for a long time. What a time to have Doug Mills on, though, right?
No doubt about it. And I also want to give a shout-out to our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty. They're still selling and listing houses.
I owe Jeff a phone call because I saw the Baltimore numbers that the sales in Baltimore are better than you think they are. So I owe Jeff a call.
Get that condo on the market. But we are delighted. Nestor, you said you'd like to have smart and talented people on the show. Well,
that's why I have you.
Not a one Pulitzer kind of guy, but let's have a guy on that's actually won two Pulitzer Prizes in his career. Pleased to welcome Doug Mills, New York Times White House photographer. Doug, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you so much for having me, Don. Thank you. I really appreciate it, guys.
So you're in D.C. How far does Baltimore feel from you? I mean, does it feel 38 miles or does it feel 3,800, Space Force miles at this point?
I just drove through Baltimore the other day driving back from Wilmington after covering President-elect Biden. So, I mean, it's a short throw from D.C. My brother lives in Baltimore, so I'm a big Baltimore fan.
Doug, I grew up at the News American, you know, and seeing the pictures. And I was the kid in 1984. They would run down to photography to come back with the picture that we were going to crop and like all of that, right? So I've been at this in camera wells, at sporting events, and Super Bowls, places you've been. But the places you've been, there's a whole different level of things that you've seen. And then there was last Wednesday, January 6th. And when we booked you on, we had no idea there'd be insurrection. Or at least maybe Don knew and I didn't know when we booked you on. But at this point, you've lived through a lot of shiz, right? I mean,
Yes. Where's
this week ranking for you as you're taking pictures in the Capitol of soldiers sleeping?
Oh, Nestor, it's, we're in different times right now. And I've been covering the White House for over 30 years and been through different administrations and lots of chaos, you know, wars overseas. And, what we're seeing right now in Washington is unprecedented. I know that word is overused, but right now it is. I mean, for me, even today, to walk into the White House today, I've got to walk five or six blocks because the perimeter has been pushed out that far and they're National Guard, Secret Service, D.C. cops, everybody's out there. And what happened last week up on the Hill, it hurts everybody's heart. And all of my colleagues up there who were photographing the unrest were, unfortunately not treated, properly at many times. My colleague, Aaron Schaff, was accosted, beat up. Her cameras taken from her, credentials because they saw that she worked at the New York Times, reached out to her and knocked her to the ground, took her cameras, trashed them. Other photographers were hit and kicked and so forth. So, it's tough being the enemy, and we are not the enemy of the people. And it's tough. And I my heart goes out to all the photographers who were up there. I happened to be up with President-elect Biden at the time, waiting for him to make a statement. I believe it was going to be on the economy. And of course, as soon as this all happened, we're all glued to our phones and watching Twitter and looking at the unrest and talking to members of the Secret Service. who can't believe it either, that it's all going on back in D.C. So
are you tier one with Biden when you're in Wilmington? I mean, are you 10 feet from him? Are you in inner circle taking pictures as the White House person? Or are you waiting for him to come to a podium at that point? I mean, do you get to see him sort of situation rooming? You know what I mean?
Not in that situation. No, we were in a, and I think it's kind of a theater situation. It's a place that he goes to.
I saw Brian Adams there. Yeah, I'm very familiar. Yeah. The Grand. Queen,
they call it. And so we were there waiting. 10 or 15 feet from him. And it ended up being delayed an hour because of so much unrest. And I'm sure they were waiting. Okay. How bad is this going to get? And then all of a sudden, once it, they stormed the Capitol.
No, but the next president of the United States is watching this on television. You're watching this on television like the rest of us. You could have been in it. You had a lot of friends. And we all had people in it.
Absolutely.
We just talked to Dutch 20 minutes. You know, Nancy, who's been on the show, right? I mean, people that were in it. I don't want to get political on how he's still the president, but after witnessing it, this next week is going to be a tough transition, and you're there with a lens to sort of capture this, and you don't know what this is going to look like, right?
I do not. And I must say that I've covered all 4 years of President Trump's term, and we've had more access to him as a body of the press, as photographers. We've had more access to him than any president I've covered. But up until Election Day, and after Election Day, it's kind of really tightened. We're not seeing him. They're using social media for him to speak, putting out speeches at night and talking about impeachment. I did travel to the border with him 2 days ago when he went to Texas and looked at the wall to inspect the construction of that. And he didn't come back on Air Force One and speak with us. There are 13 members of the traveling press corps that travel with him on every trip. I was one of them, and we have a seat. Air Force One, the New York Times has a photo seat for a photographer. And unfortunately, he didn't come back. I was really surprised that he didn't come back and speak with us. But
does he normally come back, Doug?
Oh yeah, yep, Don. He's back quite a bit, and most of it's off the record. Sometimes it's on the record, but he'll come back and chat for anywhere from 10 to 40 minutes to an hour, depending on how long the flight is. And yes, the circle's gotten so much smaller.
This is where I love the conversations that we have. And at some point, I want to go back and talk about how you got into this thing. You've been doing it almost 40 years. But when you said, I think for the average person, for me even, it just fascinates me. When you say he comes back, when a president comes back, and you've covered a bunch of them, so whether it's Obama or Trump or one of the Bushes or Reagan, do you read people pretty well, I'm guessing? Are they truly unguarded, or are they choosing every word? Or do you get a sense that you're talking to guys who have really rolled up their sleeves and just want to kick back a little?
That's a really great question, because there are times when every president that comes back to speak, and again, to try and give you a sense of where we are, we're in the rear of the aircraft. We have 13 seats back there. We don't have access beyond the next cabin, which is a Secret Service cabin for us. Members of the Presidential Protection Detail are sitting right in front of us. And then there's a conference room. And then beyond that is all the staff and senior staff and then the president. So for him to come back there, it's an effort. It's just not like walking across the hall or the
next
row.
How many people are on this plane?
150? Yeah, at the most, yeah.
Fair enough. Yep. I mean, okay.
I mean, you've got lots of, you've got the military police. You've got people in the upper part of it who are doing all of the communications work. There's lots of staff. There's lots of flight attendants that are all Air Force.
What was the first time you got on Air Force One?
Oh, my gosh. Back in 1983.
Reagan.
With Ronald Reagan. Yep, Ronald Reagan.
So it was a smaller plane, too. Smaller plane. Jump back to the question then. What's your sense of who you get when they come back? And I know they're all a little different.
I'm sorry.
And you'll talk a little bit about how they're different, because as I read about you, you have some real insights on that. But who do you get when they come back?
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. You normally get the president rolling up his sleeves and coming back and just chit-chatting. And, you know, they can be holding a cup of coffee, a soda, ties undone. Sometimes, you know, Obama would come back with his sleeves rolled up like that, and you just sit around and chit-chat. Clinton was famous for it. Clinton would talk an hour and a half easily. He'd go in from, he'd start out talking policy and then start, you know, into Arkansas sports and want to talk about the Razorbacks and stories about that. Reagan would come up with stories from California. Bush would talk about, you know, Bush 41, one of my favorites to cover because he, you know, just was so kind to me as a journalist or as a human being. He'd come back and chit chat all the time. And Bush 43, the same thing. He would come back and talk baseball. And, you know, if he wants to, if they are in a, you know, the political presidential mode, they'll come back and talk policy. And then they can say, hey, we're going off the record now. And so then reporters will just chit chat. And, you know, it's like having him sit in your living room.
Can you photograph him during those informal when he drops back?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Don. Yes. When it all depends. If it's on the record, yes, you can do it. Now, with President Trump, he would come back and talk so much. And he would walk back and say, hey, it's off the record. We're going off the record here.
What the hell could he say that could possibly be off the record? That's what I'm...
You got to wonder that, right, Nestor?
Yeah. I'm not allowed to tell you. You know, off
he was. Record. He called you a genius, you know, so,
yeah,
you know,
he
I Googled
called me that.
That
on the record, though. That was on the record.
He called you that on... Wait a minute. Hey,
on the record, are you a genius? Was he wrong about that, too?
No, I mean... Depends on who you ask. Yes, there are people.
What would your brother say? What would your brother say?
My brother would absolutely say I'm a genius. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Jump back to 41, because one of the things I read, I know you have a fondness, but, you know, you read certain things and you go, I'll be. And one of them was you and 41 became horseshoe buddies.
We did. Yeah. Ironically enough, we did. I mean, it sounds strange as hell, but. Yeah, he one afternoon sitting in the press room, which we do all day, anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12 to 15 hours. And
now that's an interesting existence because I've been there. Yeah. I mean, I avoided the mice and, like, you know, the bad coffee in the back and all that. The thing that struck me, it was in the beginning of COVID, is how small a space all of it is and how many of you. It reminds me of, like, Fenway Park for baseball, where it's just not built for, you know, it's not built for
right.
as many people.
Yep. So you guys are sitting in there and
Bush,
the president, feels
in.
Like playing horseshoes.
Well, he had just finished. He had a pretty good routine on Friday afternoons. He would play tennis. And there's a tennis court out in the back, which is recently redone. But he would play tennis. And then one day he just happened to be walking back to the West Wing and he stuck his head in the press room. And I happened to be sitting there and he said to me, Doug, hey, how's it going? What are you up to? I said, well, sir, we're waiting on you. What are you up to? He said, well, I'm going to play horseshoes. Do you know how to play? And I hadn't thrown a horseshoe since I was probably, you know, 8 or 9 years old. And I said, absolutely, sir. Yeah. He said, well, find another photographer who knows how to play and let's go. Come on, let's go play. It's like, oh my gosh. I went around and asked first 5 photographers and they were like, I've never picked up a horseshoe. Finally found another guy who was my age and said, yeah, let's go. So we went out and played. And it became a routine. Friday afternoons, I cherish those moments now. We played while Barbara Bush swam in the swimming pool right behind us. And he even invited me. And when we went up to Kenny Bunkport to one of the golf clubs that he played at, he said to me one day, man, you guys must be bored while I'm playing golf. I said, yeah, we're just sitting over in the clubhouse. I said, sure, we'd be nice to be playing golf or playing horseshoes. And he said, well, hell, I'll supply everything if you want to build it. So the club pro said, absolutely, you can build a horseshoe pit. So while he's out playing golf, he could hear us hitting the ringers, you know, and hitting the pin. And sure enough, at the end of his golf tournament, he'd come over and play.
Well, there's
and
the title of your just, book. You know, how George Bush turned me into a horseshoe player, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, you get these moments. There was another moment, Doug, that I was struck by. Maybe you can talk about. The horseshoe thing just struck me because it humanizes, you know, and again, I'm not going to ask you to comment on this. It's an editorial comment.
No,
wouldn't
absolutely.
Be fair, but I can't imagine Donald Trump saying to you one day, hey, Ken, let's go, Doug, let's go play some horseshoes. It seems to me there's something about that image of Bush 41 to me that's very, very personal and down to earth. And there's another moment. Was Reagan the first president you covered?
Yes,
I think.
Yep. Yeah. 83.
There's a moment that with someone else you described, which I thought was human, and maybe you can talk about it, was where Reagan came across you on a Christmas Eve night. Do you remember that? Because that struck me as very human also.
He did, yeah. It was a Christmas Eve night, probably in, I don't know, 85, 86. I'd have to go back. And I happened to be in the press room, the same place I was, you know, years later when George Bush came in and asked me to go play horseshoes. It was Christmas Eve, and I happened to be working for AP, and I had the night shift, 3 to 11. And I was the only one in the room. And he happened to walk in. It was late in the evening, and he poked his head in the briefing room and looked at me and said, what are you doing here? What's going on? Why are you here on Christmas Eve? I said, well, sir, it's my shift. And, you know, the Associated Press covers the White House until midnight every day. And we have,
you might do something.
Yeah, exactly. And so he said, oh, that's terrible. You can't do that. Come on over. Let's go over and say hi to Nancy. So we walked over to the, mansion to say hello to Nancy. And it was just one of those moments where you had to pinch yourself. And it's very humanized. I mean, luckily I've been involved in a number of those moments with different presidents. Every president, I could tell you, you know, a few moments like that. It was, you know, he was amazing. He invited me one time to the ranch in Santa Barbara because I was out there covering him. And he asked me to come up and watch him do one of his radio addresses, you know, and to sit in this, you know, trailer where he was doing this was, you know, phenomenal. And luckily, again, I get to see some of the human side of them, and they get to, you know, see what I do on a human side also. And I'm not just there as a political photographer.
Well, it does speak to the trust they have in you. And again, for those of you just tuning in, we are with Doug Mills, New York Times White House photographer since 2002, actually been doing this for about 40 years, doesn't have one but two Pulitzer Prizes to his name. Doug, one of the things that always fascinates Nestor and me when we talk to folks is how they end up where they are. When you're this little kid, growing up in Greensboro, and then you end up in Alexandria. But back in Greensboro days, are you a little kid that's running around with a Polaroid and an Instamatic, and you think, I'm going to be a photographer one day? How does this – most little kids aren't running around saying, I'm going to be a photographer. How did this happen?
Yeah, you're spot on with this because, yes, I was one of those kids that probably 12, 13, that was when I first got my first camera. And if you can believe it, it was something called a Pocket 110. It was the tiniest, it looked like a little spy camera, but that's what I had. And it was disposable. And basically, because I had an interest in sports, I played sports as a kid. I thought, wow, I should go take pictures of my brother Sonny playing basketball. So I went to a high school game. I wasn't even in high school, and sat there with my little point and shoot camera. And, ended up getting a job of all places at Drug Fair, a place where, you know, it was like a CVS now, where I could go in and get the film processed. And so that's where it started. I had a
Was it overnight
sports.
Then, was it? It was a week then, right?
Exactly. It was about 7 days. Can you imagine waiting for a picture, to look at a picture for 7 days?
You know, I just went through all of my pictures and I found all of the negatives. What good is a negative these days? Do you keep your negatives from 1979?
Nestor, that's a great question. Because, yeah, this past weekend I was looking through some old stuff and I was looking for an actual magazine that somebody had sent me and asked me for a copy of it. And lo and behold, there were all these negatives. And I think really the only thing you can do now, it's hard to get prints made from them, but you can scan them. There are a couple devices you can hook up to your computer now, and it'll make it a digital picture.
I need one of those. You need to lend me one of those. Google that.
they're out there, and they're great, but it takes a lot of time. I mean, we're so lucky now to transform from me going into a hotel bathroom with processing film when the president just made a statement to now just sending a picture directly from my camera back to the New York Times within seconds.
Doug, first time I ever covered a Preakness, I snuck in on a photo pass. I was running bags of film back to the News American because it was the only way to get them back there for the Preakness in 1984, you know?
No, the Preakness. I covered the Preakness for many, many years. I love that place. That was a great, great, you know.
Yeah, the pictures race. You could use and the pictures you couldn't use, right?
Exactly. Yeah, if you went to the infield, forget about it. That was just, you know. That was nothing more than eye candy and crazy people out there. It was
never convicted. Never convicted. Doug, I want to ask you about Trump because
it's. Were you out there?
Sorry. Oh, just 100 times. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Right. Well, one. It said working on my pass, but I wasn't working. I don't think. I want to ask you about Trump. Just because, I mean, he called you a genius and like all. I'm sure you know whatever that's worth. But 4 years of witnessing this to what happened last Wednesday. Put the American hat on and run us through because you're closer to the fire than any of us, quite frankly, have ever been with him.
Yeah. I have covered him for 4 years and he has called me a genius. He's called me out in front of world leaders and said, you know, he's brilliant. He's one of the best photographers in the world. Unfortunately, he works for the New York Times. And I've covered, you know, so much of his presidency. Seeing what happened last week, I've heard the rhetoric at all the, you know, rallies where he's, you know, attacked the press and attacked liberals and attacked the election results and everything like that.
You've been to a lot of these rallies, right?
My gosh, hundreds of them. Yeah, I mean, yeah, hundreds of them with all the COVID scares. I wear 2 masks like this, you know, at every rally. I wear glasses sometimes. Knock on wood, I haven't had COVID yet. Some of my colleagues have.
Have you been assaulted? Yeah,
assaulted verbally. Oh, many times. Never touched or, you know, hit or anything like that. But people yelling at you and getting right in your face and, you know, yelling obscenities at you. And sometimes it's, you know, I've defended myself one of two ways. I either, depending on what the person or how old they are, I look at them. If they look around my age or a little bit younger, I'm like, stop. I would never come to your office and yell at you. I don't know what your job is, but I'm doing my job. And I would never come at your office and start yelling at you about what you do. So please respect that. And if it's somebody who's younger, who's just trying to get a, you know, trying to get a little rise out of you. On Air Force One, there are boxes of M&Ms everywhere with the president's signature on them. And if somebody comes up and starts giving me a bunch of shit about, you know, being in the media, I'll reach out and hand them a box of M&Ms. Say, you know what? This is from the president's plane. And you would be amazed if you reach out and shake somebody's hand and give them something like that, a keepsake, the conversation changes completely.
M&M diplomacy. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's happened. I mean, I am now Instagram friends with a man who's probably in his 30s, who was a diehard Trump supporter and who was somebody who said, you know, I don't agree with your profession. I can't believe what you do. And then, so I reached out, shook his hand, introduced myself, told him what I did. And he started off on a lot of wild theories, conspiracy theories. And I said, you know, let me just, I know the president's not coming out for about 10 minutes. Let's just chat. Where do you get your news from? What's your news source? He said, well, Facebook and, you know, and Instagram. And I'm like, you know, those are really not reliable sources. And he said, what do you mean? I said, when you're looking at Twitter or Instagram and you see something that just doesn't sound right, but maybe you think it is, have you ever thought to look at another news source like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know, just somewhere else that you can fact check that? I said, well, no, I never thought about that. I said, well, I know I'm in the news business. And if you see something on Twitter, click on it and then go look for the same thing that's going on. And please try and do that. And to this day, he and I have bonded as, you know, on one, photography, and two, just on trying to find out what's real. He'll send me things and say, is this real? I'm like, no, it's not real. Here's the real story.
But at least he trusts that you would tell him the truth.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that was all lesson. Because of a handshake, you know, and it was all just saying, you know, I'm not going to, you know, fight with you. I just want to know where you're getting your information.
That gives me some hope, Doug, actually, and maybe more of what we need to do. And
well, that's going to have to happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Nestor, your question leads to so many more questions. You asked Doug if he had been abused or threatened. Doug, couple things. I'm going to go back to your colleague, and Aaron, I knew there was going to be so much talk about who got the camera, who got knocked down, got the camera destroyed. When you said that, as a golfer, I'm thinking our golf clubs are pretty special. You know, we like our clubs. We don't like the rented set of clubs. And I'm thinking of your colleague whose cameras got smashed and kicked and ruined. Are your cameras and your colleague's cameras, are they personal? When that gets destroyed, is that like
it's violated, man? You're violated.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is a our tool for life. I mean, this is our, it's in our blood. The tools that we carry around, the cameras that we carry every day, just having your credentials that has your name and your White House pass and your Senate pass. She had all of that destroyed and taken away from her. And that is, you know, so disheartening. There were two photographers who found her in the hallway after this had happened. And of course, because there's so much chaos going on, she's now visibly upset, scared to death, and looking around like somebody else is going to get me. And she is not a tall woman. And she is not a muscular woman. But she is has a big heart. And two photographers found her. Two male photographers came over and saw her. And like, what happened? What's going on? Could tell that she was crying and why she was so upset. What happened? And they told her. And of course, the police came right over and told her, you need to get out. You're with them. Get out. And they tried to say, no, she is a journalist. And they were like, where's her credentials? They stole them. They stole her cameras. Look at her. We know her. We're vouching for her. And the Capitol Police grabbed her, took her over to another room and said, then please hide in here. You are not safe out here. And so those photographers took her into that room and she stayed in that room.
And how many stories are there like that?
Wow.
Right. Yeah, literally. Yeah.
That's just
chilling.
It's still terrifying. It is chilling. You're right.
And terrifying. You know, you've been front and center, Doug, to so many amazing moments in history. And today we're just going to scratch the surface. Hopefully we can have you back. But the one when we were getting ready to have you on, I said to Nestor, I said, do you understand? Doug took the iconic photo of Andy Card leaning in to whisper to Bush 43 that the World Trade Center had been attacked. Take us back.
And you were in the room when Biden, literally last week, which is why I asked, right? Yeah. I mean, you have been front and center on these situation room things,
on
right?
these situations. So yes. We're back at that elementary school. I always break it down that there's a pre-9/11 world and a post-9/11 world. You literally were there when those worlds divided. Take us back to that elementary school. Peter Baker calls you, I think, the most important journalist that the New York Times has in Washington. Wow. So that's high praise.
That is high praise from Peter Baker,
the chief White House correspondent. So you're there that day, the most important correspondent, as Peter Baker refers to you. Take Nestor, me, and our viewers through that morning with Andy Card in that photo.
Well, I mean, it's probably one of the most memorable days of my career, and obviously one of the tragic times of our history. But yes, I was with traveling with President Bush that day. He had gone for a jog that morning, and we were then headed to this elementary school where he was going to make remarks on No Child Left Behind. It was Education Week in the Bush administration, and the First Lady was actually going to testify at the exact same time on Capitol Hill. And we were in the motorcade pulling up to the school. And again, back then, we didn't have cell phones. I mean, there weren't a lot of mobile phones around. A couple of the White House staff had them. And the gentleman in front of us, Gordon Jandro, who was our press lead, got a phone call. And he was on the phone. And as we were pulling up, he's saying, how big a plane? How many people? You know, and just talking about, you know, what we could tell was maybe a plane crash. And he got off the phone and said, okay, keep me updated. So he turned around and he said, hey, there's been a small plane crash in New York City. Don't have any other details. Don't know how big the plane was, but, you know, that's all I know. And again, we're going back to pre-Twitter, you know, everybody having a cell phone. Obviously, it was a lot of cable television, but still, we didn't have a lot of that information going into the classroom. Went into the classroom. The president's in the front of the classroom reading to children. The teacher's there. The students, they're playing little games and clapping and reading and Andy Card, who I knew from Bush 41, walked into the room. And it was one of those moments like, wow, the chief of staff just walked into the room. Wonder what's going on. Because that's a very unusual thing to happen. And having known Andy for, 4 years before and now during Bush's term, I looked at him, we made eye contact, and I was like, what's going on? And again, the room is filled with probably 20 or 25 members of the press, television, everybody's rolling. And he just, and I don't think many people looked at him the way I did to try and see what was going on. And he just looked at me and went, number two. I was like, well, number two, that doesn't mean anything. Peace? What? What's going on? So I, kept my eye on him as the president was speaking. And lo and behold, he walked up and leaned over and whispered in the president's ear. And the president looked completely stunned, as he should.
Which you captured. I mean, I got to say, Doug, I want you to keep going. Your picture captures that. Nestor just showed it. You captured that moment of the stunned look on the president's face.
Yeah, and look, I mean, and it wasn't until a week later when we went to Ground Zero, when the president flew up to Ground Zero a week later, when we were on Air Force One and the president came back and he's speaking with reporters, 2 or 3 feet from me. And Andy Card is now standing back next with me and the president's speaking and he's still obviously very upset about it. And Andy Card says to me, hey, that was a really great picture, Doug. Can I get a couple copies? And I was like, absolutely, sir. I'm happy to get you as many prints as you want. And by the way, what did you tell the president? And he said, well, I told him, Mr. President, a second aircraft has just hit the World Trade Center. America's under attack. And with that, everybody who was talking to the president now looks over to Andy Card and said, wait, Andy, what did you just say? He said, Doug just asked me what I told the president that day. And because there was so much going on, nobody thought about what he asked or what he told him that day. But because I had taken the picture and because Andy was obviously in it and a huge part of it, that sort of TikTok had not happened, going down the day, what happened, because there was so much else going on. And, that story came out right away about what he had told him. And then, there was a lot more that came out, a couple books about it. And so,
well, you were on that aircraft as well, flying back, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. After the, from Florida, you mean?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of special security, right?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, we flew from Florida, and we got up in the air, and we were flying, and we're like, "Where are we going?" And they said, "The president wants to go back to Washington." Well, that was the plan until the Pentagon was hit, the other plane crashed that was supposed to hit the Capitol.
Well, you were the only plane in the air at that time, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, and we didn't know that at that time. But when we started flying further and further east, when we're flying, we thought we were flying north, and one of the cameramen from CBS pulled out, he was a Boy Scout, always traveled with a compass. We don't have a compass in the back of the plane. We don't know whether we're going north or south, east or west. He pulls out his little compass and said, guys, we're going east, and there's no land below us. So we had gone far, far out into the ocean and kept going further and further east. And one of the Secret Service came back, who was our press agent, and I said to him, I was like, hey, what's going on? He said, we're not going back to D.C., I can tell you that. He said, there's a lot going on. So, of course, having been on Air Force One for I don't know how many years before that, up pops on the television, which we had never watched live television before on Air Force One, is live CNN. And now they're showing the second Twin Tower go down. They're talking about the Pentagon. They're talking about this other aircraft that had crashed in Pennsylvania. And so it was just like, we're not going back to D.C. right now. We don't know where we're going. And because the problem was the president wanted to address the nation, and we only found this out after the 9/11 Commission book that came out, and the whole report was that the president wanted to address the nation, and they didn't have a way on board Air Force One to do that. It wasn't capable because the technology at the time they couldn't do that. Now, if something like that happened again, the president would be able to address the nation from Air Force One. So we ended up landing in Louisiana. at Barksdale Air Force Base, where he addressed the nation then. Then we left, heading back to the plane, saying the president wants to go back to D.C. Well, now because of the commission report and one of the pilots did a TikTok on it, we didn't know that the Air Force and the Secret Service and everybody else had said, we need a smaller footprint. We cannot put you back on the big Air Force One. We can't do that. There's too much risk going on. And so they told us, okay, the 13-member press corps is going from 13 to 5. And without questions, here are the 5 people that are getting off and going on with us the rest of the day. And I happened to be one of them. I was the Associated Press photographer. They said, Mills, get off the bus. You're going. So I had to go down and get into a van. And they drove us back to Air Force One. There were just 5 of us at this point. And we thought we were going to get on a much smaller, you know, like private, you know, a military, you know, like corporate jet. And sure enough, when they pulled up out there and they had the other plane there and they had Air Force One, the regular big Air 747, apparently it was quite an argument with President Bush. And he said, I'm not getting on that plane. I am not cowering from anybody. I'm not hiding. We're going on this plane. Get everybody off that plane and let's go. We're taking this plane. I'm not afraid of anything. Let's go. Even though they knew that Air Force One had been a threat. I mean, it's one point when we were leaving, when we left Florida, having, you know, I think about looking back at this now, we're flying and all of a sudden all the Air Force police who sit on the other side of the plane are coming over to our side and saying, all right, guys, we're in unprecedented times. Everybody dump everything out of your bags that you have. The overnight bags have already been looked in, but your computer bags, any backpack that you have, we have no idea what's on this plane right now. We don't want to make sure that nobody puts something in your luggage, even though it had already been checked by the Secret Service and the EOD Explosive Ordnance Detail Team before we got on the plane. But they were so worried because word had come, you know, that we didn't know, but they had gotten word that Air Force One was a target. So we dumped everything out on the floor and it was like, what's the next shoe that's going to fall? I mean, we were petrified. And I've always told my wife when I leave to go on a trip and my children, I'm on the safest airplane in the world. And that was the only time I've ever felt unsafe was when they started telling us, hey, you got to dump everything out of your bag. We got to make sure nobody puts something in your bag you don't know about.
No, I want to ask you about that, but go ahead, security, because, and this brings us to present day. This week, we have members of Congress skipping the security detail. Right. I mean, like, how can that happen? I'm literally like, I'm at a loss watching the impeachment where members that were part of an insurrection have skipped. My biggest fear through everything last week was that there was a bomb inside the Capitol. Like that's what I thought was going to happen. I thought that was the inevitable thing, not people with, you know, flagpoles, quite frankly.
Right. And I agree. The fact that people now are members of Congress, because you have to remember that those magnetometers have been there since 9/11, and all the members of the press, all public goes through there. If you've ever been there, you've gone through it. But if you have a, you know, staff pen or a member of Congress, not a staff pen, but a member of Congress pen, Senate or House of Representatives, you bypass that. You can walk right past that and keep going. And there's no, even if there's a line, you just go right in. And for them now, I'm sure there are members who are more put off by the inconvenience of it and maybe a little pride, but also the other members saying, wait, we don't trust anybody right now. If there were actually, as reported, by a member of Congress, that there may have been some recon going on, that tourists might have been led through there to look at, you know, different parts of the Capitol to see what doors or whatever, or in one of the videos that surfaced now of somebody having blueprints of the damn Capitol once they got in the building, you know, and they're all looking around at this door goes here. And I mean, that is chilling. So I think that the speaker should be fining people for that.
Well, we are with Doug Mills, New York Times photographer, White House photographer. Don, there's a local connection here that brought all this together, so I want to bring it back to that.
Oh, there is a local connection. Doug's brother. See, your younger brother or older brother, Ken?
He's my older brother. Yeah.
His older brother, Ken, runs the Revenue Authority in Baltimore County, in charge of all the golf courses, all the parking facilities. Does a great job, and I know he's proud of his brother. Doug, do you, when you were describing, I'm looking at Nestor, and I'm thinking of myself when you're describing that 9/11 day. Do you keep a journal of these things that happen, so that at one day when it strikes your fancy, you'll be able to sit down and put this in some kind of book form as sort of a reflections of a photographer over the years? Do you write this stuff down?
I do have some notes, and great question, because this year at Christmas, I have two wonderful daughters who are in their mid-20s, and both of them said to me, "Dad, you need to write a book. And you need to get like a recorder and just start talking into it when a story that you think about comes to you, and start putting this down, because you may have a piece of paper somewhere, but if you put this in and digitize it, it'll be there. It'll be there. You've got to do this." So I bought a recorder, and that's one of the things I'm going to start doing in the car. Like if I'm driving somewhere, I'm going to start, you know, remembering stories, telling stories. Because, yeah, I hope to write a book one day. Because,
well, you should. I agree with your daughters 100%. By now, unless we've been under some kind of a rock, most Americans who pay any kind of attention know Pete Souza, right? Pete Souza's become like this cult figure. We've got a show on TV. We've got this huge Instagram. So I know, for those of us who don't quite get the pecking order, so Pete is... or was the presidential photographer, I guess, Shalaya, I guess, is now his successor. Right. But people are very familiar with Pete Souza, I guess, all the way back to Reagan, up through Obama. So Pete's the presidential photographer. You're the New York Times White House photographer. How does that work in terms of the interaction between you and a Pete Souza?
Pete was a news photographer before he was a presidential photographer. Pete worked at the Chicago Tribune. Fantastic photographer. He and I have had our differences about how to cover the White House, but yes, he worked for Ronald Reagan and he worked for Barack Obama. And his relationship with Barack Obama came because he was a journalist at the Chicago Tribune and went on a trip to Africa with Obama, and he loved, you know, at the time, Senator Obama loved the pictures, and Pete happened to be around when he was running for president, and he covered the campaign. And at the end of it, he offered him a job. And I know Pete really weighed that. What should I do? I'm a journalist again. And should I do it? Should I cross over? But he did. And I remember him telling me, "Oh, I'll probably just stay for about 6 months and get this, you know, photo team up and running. And then I'm out." And lo and behold, he stuck around for the full 8 years and is now making millions off of those books.
I'm going to say, now has coffee table books. Now, you mentioned Nestor loves conflict. He loves conflict. So I'm going to take this question
That's
right
not out true.
Of I'm going to take this question right
That's
out of his mouth.
It's not true at all.
You and Pete knocked head a couple of times.
Number of times.
What do you knock heads over?
Well, and back to your first question also, as a journalist who works at the White House, all you want is access. Everything is about access and having access to the president, to be able to show people who can't be in the room and can't go to the photo ops or can't go on a foreign trip what actually happens in the room. So the conflict between Pete and I was, I criticized him for not helping facilitate news photographers getting more access to the president. And yes, we've butted heads. We actually, unfortunately, aren't in speaking terms because of it, because Pete took it so personally, but that happens. And I fought like hell for the press corps as a whole to have more access to Obama, because we saw Pete doing all of these, you know, wonderful photos and different situations that normally the press corps during previous administrations would be allowed in to cover. But now all of a sudden, you know, I'll give you, you're probably asking, give me a quick example. Veterans Day or Memorial Day, I think it was, President Obama met with the oldest living African-American World War II vet. And lo and behold, they're up in the Blue Room having this wonderful moment together. And the only way we found out, we looked up on TV and saw, you know, whitehouse.gov, and we saw his tweet and his Instagram photos. And that's infuriating that somebody from the media should not be in there to photograph. That picture would have been on the front page of newspapers all over the country. And I was very critical of the press office and Pete for not advocating for us to be in there for that.
This is the way of the world, by the way. The Ravens operate the same way.
Nestor, how do you feel about press access?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the same thing with NFL. You know, my business over 30 years, and the Orioles took my press pass 15 years ago because I told the truth. You know what I mean? So kicking people out of the media, this has been something that as we get up on to Trump, everybody likes to tell their own story now, right? Everybody's their own PR department.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that just, you know, it's, and again, it came on because of Instagram and Twitter. You know, that was not you know, the White House could put out a photo release, you know, before Instagram and Twitter that not a lot of people would see. But with the advent of, you know, the social media, now you have a full unfiltered, you know, and as I said, and I got criticized very heavily for bringing it up to the former press secretary who was here, Jay Carney, just saying, you know, I felt it was propaganda. And if you're not going to let the media in, you're putting out what you want us to see, not what really happened. And
good for you.
That might be why Peter Baker has such respect for your work and the other New York Times reporters, because they see you as fighting for their access. You've been very gracious with your time. I do have a couple of quick things, and they're on the technical side, but I found them interesting. One was this idea that from your sports background, covering the Olympics, covering Super Bowls, you were familiar, and I don't know what this is, and I want you to walk me through it and why it matters in your business, that you were familiar with the use of remote cameras really weren't being used in your official line of work, and you're the first to really do that. Tell our audience what that means, the use of remote cameras, what it meant in sports, and how you brought it over to politics.
Oh, great question, Don. Yeah, remote cameras are used more. Let's see. Let's take, for instance, the Olympics, Summer Olympics, the 100-meter dash, which happens in less than 10 seconds. And it is a race that is covered in all different angles. And I am usually right down at the finish line with the sprinters coming right at you, and they're coming at you so fast.
And this is Usain Bolt, right? This is his specialty, right?
Usain Bolt, yep, absolutely. Perfect example. And so remote cameras are taken with a camera that you set up maybe an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours before the race that has a different lens, a different focal length, may have a little more wide angle, a little different shutter speed. But they're all focused in different areas of the race. Somebody fell down halfway, if there was a foul, or at the end of the race, right where everybody's reaching for that finish line. So you have a camera down on the ground that's shooting up. You may have one at the other end in case somebody from lane five happens to beat somebody who's in the fastest lane, which is usually lane four or lane one. So you have a lot of different remote cameras. And those are all fired electronically. There are two different ways, really, electronically, or you could have them something called hard lines, which is basically, think of like the cable that goes to your lamp in your house. We'll take 250 feet of that lamp cable, same two wires, and run that all the way around, obviously not across the course, but maybe underneath the track or in a different area above and everywhere. So then those cameras are all, with that wire, hooked to different cameras, and they're all focused on different areas. And you can either fire that with a thumb switch or a foot pedal, much like a drummer who's, you know, got a foot pedal there hitting, you know, the bottom drum. So that's how those are fired. And they're all fired at the same time as they come down the track. Now you can do it with Ethernet cable. Our cameras have a port that go in. And so when I hit this shutter on my camera that I'm holding, it fires all those other cameras that are pre-focused in different areas. So the technology's come a long way. So yeah, I found the remote cameras during sports to be so helpful to get different angles. And then when I brought them to the White House to use them, I remember during the Bush administration, people going, whoa, what are you doing? I said, I'm just putting a camera over there because I know the Secret Service won't allow me to put it over in the corner on the side when the president walks in or walks out. They were like, yeah, we'll take a look at it. We'll see how this looks. So I said, just think of it as having a photographer over there, but there's nobody there. You're not put out. Secret Service knows there's somebody over there. And I'm just firing it electronically. There, I'm firing it wirelessly because I can't put any... There's a device called a pocket wizard that's made for photographers. And I can fire it remotely from there. And once they started seeing how many different angles you can have with the president and how you can do different things without having to impede his walkway. So if you put one photographer there, then you got to put 5 or 10 photographers over there. But if you put 5 remotes on the ground or 10 remotes, there's no threat there. There's no, you know, you can have them up above. I love putting them up above the president looking down. You know, they're safety.
Well,
safety
you're also cable. Known for that, right, Doug?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
one
of the things people say. What I read was people say, Doug likes vantage points. What the heck? I said, I'm going to have Doug tell me, what the heck does that mean when they say, Doug likes vantage points? What does that mean?
I love the vantage point, but also the bird's eye view. That's how you think of it, as a bird's eye view. If a bird's flying over a scene, you know, like James Comey sitting at the, you know, at the head of the table, you know, as a witness, or flying above as the president walks into the East Room.
Well, those remote cameras over basketball courts have been very, very effective forever.
Very good.
Yeah, those are the iconic sports pictures, I think, are basketball above the court where all the guys are looking up for the ball, like literally.
Or even through the plexiglass the glass on the back of the rim.
Unless, you know, Dawkins is breaking it at that point, right?
The other picture I think of you that you've captured that most people have seen now is that sort of sarcastic clap from our friend, the speaker, at the end of the State of the Union address. Was that you or was that a remote camera?
That was me. Yeah. I happen to be, well, you've done your homework here, Don. Yes. That is a memorable picture from this administration also, of Nancy Pelosi during President Trump's State of the Union address. I was the pool photographer on the floor. So I was with the president's photographer, which was great because we were both in the same orbit there. That was Shayla Craighead, who's President Trump's photographer. And on the House floor during the State of the Union, now there's a one still photographer rotation. And that happened to be my lucky night. And lo and behold, I knew that there'd been a lot of conflict between the speaker and the president because 2 weeks before that, I was in the Oval Office and they got into a shouting match in front of the media. You know, he and the speaker, Senator Schumer, and the president just got into this huge argument, which was, you know, so awkward just to be in. I mean, when you're around adults screaming at each other, it's a little awkward if you're not a part of it. But it had happened, and I knew that there had been a conflict between the two of them, and they were, you know, a lot of, you know, animosity. And when, you know, the president said something about, oh, well, we're going to work together and we're going to try and reach across the aisle, you know, and Speaker Pelosi put out her hands, you know, very condescending clap towards him saying, okay, yeah, right, let's do this. You keep talking about this, but it's not, I don't see it coming. So yeah, it was just one of those moments that people have gotten tattoos with the damn thing, you know, which is crazy. You know, I mean, there are stickers and t-shirts and tattoos out there that people have taken that iconic picture and, you know, used.
It's pretty famous. So real quick, Nestor may have one or two more things. How well, what's your sense of the access that you'll have? I'm sure you've talked to your reporters, to the Biden presidency. I'm sure that's one of the things that every photographer and every reporter is thinking, what kind of access am I going to have now that we got Uncle Joe in there instead of whatever we've had for the past 4 years?
It's going to be, yes, because, again, let's go back to our current President Trump, who has changed.
Not for long.
Not for long.
If you're going to be coming back on the show again, it's not going to be for long.
Yeah, but we've had more access to him because he is somebody who loves to drive the narrative. He loves to drive Twitter. He loves to drive whatever's on Fox television. He loves to drive whatever's on every television, and he wants to be there. So we will probably go back to more of an Obama type press, you know, access. I think we'll probably have more photo access than we did during Obama, my hope is, because it was a little tight for a while. But I don't, unlike now when we go into a, you know, President Trump cabinet room meeting, which is typically other presidents is maybe 2 or 3 minutes long for us, maybe five, where with Trump, you were in there for 90 minutes or more while everybody, you know, went around the room and praised what was going on and told us everything that was happening. But yeah, I think it, that's a great question because yes, we all are talking about, we hope to have, more access to, President Biden than we did to President Obama.
So Nestor, what do you think? Man. We need to have Doug back. You think?
Yeah, Doug, we're going to get you back. And you know, at some point we're going to take the gloves off and get the shot and the mask and like do all this stuff. We're not that far from DC. So, you know, at some point we hope to get over this hump here. I hope you get some good pictures of some peaceful activities in the next 6 months.
Absolutely.
We don't have so much conflict that Don somehow thinks I like.
I'm with you. I hope we have a really smooth day. I'm so sad to hear the news about him not taking the train down now because of security reasons. I mean, I'm heading up to Wilmington this week to come back with, President-elect Biden. And news came out that he's canceled that train trip, which is part of his, you know, the fabric of him. I mean, he drove, went up and down those rails for years when he worked in the Senate, and
it's just because he wanted to come through Baltimore twice a day. That's all.
Exactly. Yeah.
Doug, I call this, Nestor's heard me say this on other shows today, I call the disruption of these inaugural events from public access to the fact that the president, who was the senator from Amtrak, can't take the Amtrak down. This is truly, to me, Donald Trump's final finger to the country, I guess is the way I can say it.
Yeah, it's and I, you know, and I understand from a security point that, you know, trying to secure that much railroad is so hard. But yeah, it's really disheartening to know that people have actually put out some sort of physical threats or verbal threats about his transportation down here. And, it's a shame. Maybe you should just go from Baltimore to D.C., fly down to Baltimore, drive to Baltimore, get on the train and take from Baltimore in, that would be great. I'm sure you'd have a great crowd in Baltimore for it.
Well, we're living through some weird times. You'll be capturing it for the New York Times. Doug, we really appreciate you visiting with us. Thank you very, very much.
Nestor, I'm happy to come back anytime, Don. Anytime you guys want me to come back, you guys are class acts. I'm happy to do it.
I'll tell you that. It's for you to figure that out. Former Baltimore County Executive Don Mohler, our friend. By the way, we have sat and talked to Dutch Ruppersberger and all the Baltimore County executives. You're going to find that out at Baltimore Positive. What we have lovingly called Election Palooza, we're going to call Impeach Palooza this week. So that'll all be available. And of course, Ravens playoff. And at some point, we'll do some fake Radio Row thing before the Super Bowl 2 weeks from now. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.